very welcome everyone to Dallas Philosopher's Forum. We're glad to see everybody out on a crisp, slightly rainy. Oh, can we get the Martin? Can we get the music?
Martin,
can we get the music stopped or turned off, please? Some good music. We can't. We have a hard time.
Yeah.
Mexican music, Hispanic music, and Heidegger may not go together really well. Yeah, we need the German music. That's right. So anyway, we're dedicated, our Dallas Philosopher's Forum is dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to the DFW Metroplex. And I want to thank everyone for coming out. I'm Rob Olson. I'll be the MC tonight. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. And I was wondering if we have any first-time visitors. We have Katrina, first-time visitor from Michigan. And we have who are you?
Ross?
Yes. And Courtney, okay, where are you students from?
Richland.
Okay, that's very good. Very good. I went to school at Richland many, many years back. Didn't you teach at Richland, Bob?
Where?
Richland.
Yeah.
You taught at Richland. So Bob is a philosophy professor. Amongst many other places, he taught philosophy at Richland College.
That was the last one.
That's right.
Not that anymore, no.
And anyway, so if you haven't paid already, our esteemed treasurer, Dr. Alcat, he will collect the $5. So if you haven't paid, it's $5. And if you're a student, it's $2. So if you haven't paid, if you got here before he did, then please make sure you pay after the lecture. And if you want to become a subscriber, it's $35 for 6 months worth of lectures. So it's a great bargain. It's a much better bargain than buying the Dallas Cowboy football team. We also take donations as well. And so also I want to remind everyone to pay for your food and drink. Every once in a while we all inadvertently forget to pay, and then we get stuck with the bill, and we are a poor, not-for-profit agency. So we want to remind you to do that, but normally that's not a problem. Now we have our spring schedule out, and if anyone has not got a copy, it's on our website, www.philosophersforum.org. But if you want a copy of our schedule, hard copy, traditional copies, let me know, and then we can get you a copy of this. You can pick it up afterwards, because we've got six more lectures. After today, we have six more lectures for this series. And so we're all excited. We've got a wide variety of topics. We have topics on ethics of medical care, on voodoo pharmacology, on Chinese thought. We have a Chinese scholar coming up in the next few weeks. And skepticism to the president of the Dallas... North Texas Skeptics Society, who will be here as well. So our website has a lot of the same information, and so take a look at that, and then also you can sign up for the meetup group, and you can get notification of our meetings there as well. So David, would you want to stand up and promote? We have a summer event coming up. And so David's going to talk about that just for a second.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Rob. Last year we didn't get to do this last summer, but summer's past, we had the tradition that the Philosopher's Forum sponsors a special
summer
event.
Yeah.
And they've been in the form of debates or... special lectures and that sort of thing. We've come up with the exciting idea of having Philosopher's Jeopardy. And we're going to invite three universities. We've got SMU and UTA, UT Arlington Online so far. So if we have three universities, we're going to have teams of a professor as a coach and two students from each one, and they will kind of be the contestants. And one of our own, David Drum, will probably be the MC and ask the questions or ask the answers, and they have to do the questions, right?
Right.
And then we will have prizes for them. This will be in July, and the date's going to be determined.
15th or the 22nd.
Yeah, 15th or the 22nd. It'll be a
Tuesday night, right?
Yeah. And the venue isn't determined yet, but it'll probably be on the SMU campus, like it has been previously. And we are going to offer cash prizes to all three contestants as a prize for their donation to their departments, philosophy departments. So we're trying to raise money as sponsors, you know, for the event. And so we're going to have a little program with, you know, the participants, and then on the back there'll be sponsors and then contributors, and we're asking for sponsors for a large a business size card would be $100, smaller spaces would be $50, and then just for a contributor $20, you know, to have your name on there. So think about it. All of the members of the board will have these little things, so you can approach Jack or Carl or Bob or myself, Kim, and that's everybody that's here tonight. Anyway, so think about that, and we're going to plan for a really nice program this summer.
Thank you, Robert.
Okay.
So before we introduce our esteemed speaker tonight, I ask you to please turn off your cell phones and put them on silent mode. And now I'd like to give you a little bit of background on our speaker tonight, Dr. Gary Brown with Collin College. I was looking through his curriculum vitae, and it's a very impressive resume. He has his PhD from University of Texas at Dallas in the Graduate School of Arts and Humanities, History of Ideas program. He started off doing a lot of computer programming, software engineer, but he's also got all 3 degrees in philosophy. He's a specialist in Nietzsche, in Kant, in Heidegger, and also is a member of been very active in the C.C. Jung Society of North Texas. And he's an adjunct professor at Collin College the last 3 years. And he's going to be speaking on what he calls a great heavyweight debate. Heavyweight fight. Now, you've heard of Clay Liston. And you've heard of Ollie Frazier, and you've heard of Tyson Holyfield, but that ain't got nothing to Sarah Heidegger. And so, do y'all know that today is the 50th anniversary of the Cassius Clay Sonny Liston fight? 50 years ago. And I remember listening to that fight. My dad was doing some plumbing work. I was 8 at the time. My dad was doing some plumbing work, and we were listening to the Clay Liston fight while I was watching my dad do the plumbing. So, but anyway, now we have a different type of heavyweight debate tonight. And the topic, once again, is Heidegger versus Kucera, the heavyweight bout of the century. Please join me in a warm welcome to Dr. Gary Brown.
Well, I'd like to thank Rob and all the directors of the Philosophers Forum, and all of you coming out tonight on a somewhat rainy night, cold night. And I first heard about the debate between Ernst Cassirer and Martin Heidegger when I was an undergraduate at the University of Texas deep into the last century. And then when I first came to Dallas, somewhere in the early 90s or mid-90s, there was a Professor Olson who taught at North Texas who gave a talk here at the Philosophers Forum on this topic. And he chose Cassirer as the winner. He said it was thought at the time it happened that Heidegger won, and he said the tide was turning toward Cassirer.
And I vowed that night that I was going to come and give the rebuttal to that. And, so unfortunately, I wasn't able to do it during his lifetime. He's been dead now. Is there anybody here who remembers him? So am I. He used to be a regular up here, and so I'm like an ancient blast from the past here that's come. And but I'd like to dedicate the talk to him since I. Osley, Professor Osley.
Oh, I know him very well.
Oh, okay, great.
We're a very good friend.
Okay, well, I hope, and he founded the Heidegger Symposium, and I just gave a talk at the 31st Annual Heidegger Symposium, which is still going on. It's outlived him. It's been taken over by the Dasein Group, and it usually takes place at University of Dallas. So I'm glad that there's at least someone here that... and recognize this. So this happened in 1929. So it's Ernst Cassirer versus Martin Heidegger. So the question is this a ripple in the history of philosophy? Is it a regression to metaphysics? Or is it a leap forward to a new meaning of man and being? Or is it, are the incompatibilities both express two legitimate domains of thought? So the disagreement that still fascinates, aside from the many references to the 1929 Dadaist debate and the studies of either Cassirer or Heidegger, and the many standalone articles and dissertations below are some of those recent accounts. So the actual protocol of the disputation is in the Kant and the Problem of Metaphysics that was published in 1997. So you can read, it's not a word-for-word account, but it's what we have from it. It was a student of Heidegger's and a student of Cassirer's got together, and then Heidegger looked over it when it was published in the book. So in the year 2000, Michael Friedman at MIT wrote a book called The Carting of Ways, Carnap, Cassirer, and Heidegger. And he described the split between Anglo-American philosophy and continental philosophy as laid through Heidegger's door. And then it was, of course, exacerbated by World War II and the Nazis, where the two branches of philosophy couldn't speak to each other, and they lost the ability to talk to each other, and which is now being, people are trying to come back together, and you know, analytical philosophers are now writing about Heidegger, and you know the continental people are studying some of the analytical philosophers. So in 2008, the Edward, let's see, get to where I make it. Okay, so, you know, I see people doing these talks, and then I say, well, how come they, okay, so Edward Skidelsky, so he did, I can't make the red light come on. Oh, there it is. Okay, he did one on the Ernst Cassirer, the last philosopher of culture, and he talked about the debate, and then in 2010, the continental divide, Heidegger, Cassirer, Davos, and I put on some of the tables, I took a picture from the cover. You can see Heidegger is the small guy over here, and Cassirer is the tall guy with the bushy white hair here. So it's not a very good picture, but it gives you some idea about them. So the two positions of Davos may uncover an archetypal tension in philosophical thought. The Cassirer-Heidegger encounter shattered the dominance of neo-Kantianism, and it marked a significant bifurcation in modern philosophical ideas. And it might also indicate the only significant counterthrust to the total appropriation and concealment of human essence by technology. All right, so what was the occasion? So in Switzerland, they formed this was at the second annual meeting of the International Davos Conference, the Internationale Davos or Hochschulkurse. And it's at the Davos is the highest city in Europe. It's a mile high in the Alps. And it's a famous spa resort and conference center. It's where the Thomas Mann's novel Magic Mountain took place. It was a tuberculosis sanatorium at the top of it, which is overlooking the village. And then it's where the present World Economic Forum meets. So you all the time read about Davos, and it's still the same place. So the purpose was a colloquy of intellectuals across Europe to promote peace and mutual understanding after the devastation and residual enmities of World War I. We all know how successful that was. So there were over 50 docenten and professors, 232 students from 20 countries, many of them veterans of World War I. And there were 950 inhabitants of the village of Davos.
And of course, they came mostly to the evening events rather than going to the classes. So the sampling of those present is Terry Maria Ray Marquet. So if you know All's Quiet on the Western Front, very great novel. Emmanuel Levinas, Totality and Infinity. He was a Heideggerian, but also turned against Heidegger. Ludwig Binswanger, the existential psychiatrist. Rudolf Carnap, the philosopher of science and logical positivist. And many others who trained the next two generations of European thinkers, the teachers of Gilles Deleuze and Jacques Derrida. So the participants, so Ars Cassera is probably best known, the red button. Wait a minute, what happened here? That's a dangerous button, it goes to skips. Okay, he's best known for The Philosophy of the Enlightenment. It's one of the best books on the Enlightenment, still. And he wrote an essay on man here in the United States. He had to flee the Nazis. Cassera was a Jew, fled the Nazis. He went, taught 2 years at Oxford. He taught 5 years in Sweden. He caught the last boat out of Sweden before the Nazis came in and came to the United States. He taught at Yale and Columbia. Before the debate in 1929, he had written Substance and Function when he said that you could no longer think of the word being as having substance. It was more like a mathematical function. He did a 10-volume complete collection of Kant's works. And he did a book called Kant's Life and Work, which is still one of the best books as an introduction to Kant. And it has the advantage of treating all three critiques of Kant as one project, which is very rare in Kant approaches, but they were one project. So he then did the Einstein Sphere and Relativity, and Einstein read and approved the article. And then he did Philosophy of Symbolic Forms, where he took Kantian language, Kantian transcendental structures, and applied them to cultural things, applied them to language, applied them to mythical thought and religion and art, applied them to the mythology, the phenomenology of knowledge. And while he was doing that, he did the individual cosmos of Renaissance philosophy. He did about twice this number of books, which I just wanted to give you a sense to know who he was. He's from a prominent Jewish family. After World War I, he was named professor at the University of Hamburg and elected rector. He was the first Jew to ever attain such a position in Germany. So he was tall, urbane, elegant. In 1929, he had the bushy white hair. When he was under the weather during the concert, he was bedridden part of the time. He began as a neo-Kantian. He became more Kantian. Then he was influenced by Hegel, and he treated philosophy historically, and he became a philosopher of culture. So Heidegger was best known for Being and Time, which is a powerful rethinking of the meaning of truth, temporality, being, and human existence. Because of the language of Being and Time and its obvious originality, the book made quite a stir, but people yet didn't know how to adapt to it, didn't know what to make of it. So he was first thought to be an existentialist, but he rejected that term. And his analytic of human being was not in service of anthropology or ethics, but in order to gain access to the primordial meaning of being, to re-raise the question left back where it stood with Aristotle. He wanted to look at the being itself instead of being as a background to beings. So the first time since Aristotle, Heidegger drawing on Kant, countered the notion of being as eternal and unchanging. This was, he argued, a false understanding of time, a mistaken fixation on presence at the expense of the other modes of standing outside of oneself, i.e. into the past and to the future. So human essence is as time. So the being of things objectively present, objectivity, objective things, dominates Western ontology. Our whole language is based on being able to describe things. The objective presence is an abstraction that's based upon a more primordial awareness and cannot grasp human Dasein, according to Heidegger. So he was born to a poor Catholic family, was taught by the Jesuits, and switched to philosophy. And in 1929, he had only published Being and Time. 10 years before that, he had published nothing. So Cassera was well known, and Heidegger knew Cassera's works quite well. But Cassera he read Being in Time about 2 weeks before the conference. And it's not a book that you can absorb in 2 weeks. So the agenda of the conference was it was a three-week. Some of the schedules I have indicate 4 weeks, so most people call it 3 weeks. that and had morning and afternoon classes by quite a number of professors. And but Cassera taught four classes, and Heidegger taught three. So Cassera, even though he was a specialist in the philosophy of science, he offered a course on philosophical anthropology, probably because that's the way he understood Heidegger, that he felt that Heidegger was in the recent philosophy of life tradition of Nietzsche, Kierkegaard, Bergson, and Durkheim. So Heidegger, to Cassera's surprise, lectured on the rethinking of Kant's critique of pure reason as a grounding metaphysics, a topic that grew out of his winter semester that he had just finished. And it was also, Being in Time was not a complete book, it was a fragment. And the next step that he was going to do was a deconstruction of Western ontological history. The first element of that was going to be Kant, and then Descartes, and then Aristotle. So even though he didn't finish the book, he had to rethink the structure of it. He still taught the course on Kant, and he worked up to write. And then after this conference, 3 weeks later, he published a book on Kant. So Cassera and Heidegger were the two most famous philosophers in Germany. If you read the book Continental Divide, you see three different universities in Germany what needed professors, and Cassera and Heidegger were the ones that showed up for all three of these cases. It was always between the two of them. They were the leading lights of Germany. So they were the attraction that this conference was going to be this face-to-face. They called it Arbeitsgemeinschaft. They didn't want to call it a debate or a disputation, because it was a conference to solve, you know, to ease confrontation. And they didn't want this, so this Arbeitsgemeinschaft is more of like a workshop-friendly, you know, relationship, and it's not confrontational at all. So just between them, now Einstein had been the major attraction the year before, in 1928. He said this encounter occurred on Tuesday of the second week, and sometime later, Levinas and Volno reenacted the debate at night. So Levinas had this bushy hair, it was black, and he put powder all over it, and then when they enacted it, he kept saying, "I love culture, I love culture." And the one playing Heidegger kept saying, "To interpret something is to turn it upside down, to interpret." And so they got a big laugh out of that. Later on, after the Nazis took charge, and Heidegger was associated with the Nazis, Levinas was chagrined the fact that he had made fun of Cassera, and he apologized to Cassera's widow later for his role in that skit. So the format of that kind of already talked about, it was called an Arbeitsgemeinschaft, to keep it informal, but it nevertheless exposed a major rift between two fundamentally different viewpoints, one an evolution of, and the other a revolution against the philosophical tradition. Both thinkers could be regarded as being in advance of their own era, and perhaps in some ways ours. Cassera confidently extended the rationalist tradition into new domains of language, myth, art, and religion, while Heidegger, agreeing with Nietzsche, traced the rise of modern nihilism back to the deficiencies of the rationalist tradition and sought to recover its lost abyssal depths. So the encounter was brief, lasted 2 hours. It says, unlike modern political debates with pre-formulated questions, this event was unscripted and unmoderated. So each philosopher made a statement, then posed questions to the other, who responded and raised his own questions. There were only four complete exchanges, but each contained multiple explicit and implicit issues that were still unpacking. Cassera, older by 15 years, an established author, began with the apparent intent of gaining a better understanding of Heidegger's recent and difficult book. Although they had previous conversations, Heidegger had actually reviewed a book by Cassera. Heidegger was still relatively known philosophically to Cassera. Heidegger took the opportunity, for his part, to promulgate his revolutionary stance toward the whole philosophical tradition, going back to Aristotle, Plato, and Parmenides, which he saw was fulfilled and exhausted. Okay, the two men, even though they were less than a generation apart, their respective comings of age were separated by World War I, which terminated the Age of Enlightenment with the Age of Anxiety and Crisis. So Cassera had written his dissertation on Descartes, his first book on Leibniz, and his philosophy of symbolic form celebrated the liberation of mankind from primitive bondage to freedom through the progressive unfolding of infinite reason. Even the Great War brought a republic to Germany and allowed Cassera, a Jew, to be appointed professor at the University of Hamburg. But Kassira's mode of speaking was described as polite, formal, elegant, and pastoral. His tall Libyan bearing was accentuated by his bushy white hair, but he seemed to represent the old discredited rational order. Sahidur, by contrast, was small, dark, and tense, and as Kassira's wife described him, was socially uneasy and looked like a workman or a peasant. Heidegger cultivated this rustic impression by wearing his ski clothes to formal events. And he bragged in a letter that this was unheard of. And when he taught, a lot of times he would wear lederhosen and stuff. Said that he was described as energetic, resolutely serious to the point of rudeness and standoffish. But he appealed to the younger generation, some of whom skied with him. It was a generation marked by war, uncertainty, and economic deprivation, and was drawn to nature, hiking, and camping. No longer enthralled by the promise of reason, they found Heidegger's reflection on anxiety, authenticity, resoluteness in the face of death, and the questioning of all conventional truths quite to their liking. They were in search of a new world order, and were especially drawn to the pathos and assurance that Heidegger projected. So the first round out of four. Kassira began the encounter quite confidently by asking Heidegger, whom he seemed to regard as a less experienced younger colleague, why he attacked neo-Kantianism, especially since Kassira's own work had expanded beyond his neo-Kantian mentors at Marburg. He even doubted Heidegger's grasp of the term and claimed surprise at seeing neo-Kantianism even in Heidegger. Kassira, understandably, had not yet recognized Heidegger's stature as an original figure of the first rank, and he might be poking a bear. So Heidegger, despite condescension in the question, gave a measured response. Because the topic is significant, I quote his answer at length. This is Heidegger. Since about 1850, it has been the case that both human and the natural sciences have taken possession of the totality of what is knowable. So the question arises, what still remains of philosophy? If the totality of beings has been divided up under the sciences, that it remains for neo-Kantians just a knowledge of science, not of beings. And it is from this perspective that their regression to Kant has been determined. Consequently, Kant is seen as a theoretician of the mathematical physical theory of knowledge. This is exactly the way Kassira's mentor, Hermann Cohen, regarded Kant. So with Heidegger, he says, for me, what matters is to show what came to be extracted here as a theory of science was non-essential for Kant. Kant did not want to give any sort of theory of natural science, but rather wanted to point out the problematic of metaphysics, which is to say, ontology. So ontology is a study of being. What matters to me is to work this core content of the positive element of the Critique of Pure Reason into ontology in a positive way. So they have a very different reading, different way of approaching Kant. So this divide between Kassira and Heidegger, their readings of Kant, as it meant that this divide has become manifest. Now, they both had a neo-Kantian background. Neo-Kantians dominated the early 20th century. So Heidegger did not need to mention that before 1850 was dominated by Hegel's idealism. So Hegel's predecessor, Kant, it included sensibility as one of the stems of knowledge. So knowledge was involved in sensibility and reason. They emerged a synthesis of the two. Hegel rejected this inclusion of sensibility with the claim that reason was self-sufficient. Reason had to supply its own presuppositions, like a snake eating its own tail. But after Hegel died, the back to Kant cry arose. You know, so people were saying it's back to Kant. So, but its participants, which led to the neo-Kantian domination of the 20th century, retained against Kant Hegel's rejection of sensibility. So, for example, Paul Nottorf, one of Kassira's neo-Kantian mentors at Marburg, declared that his intention was never to revive orthodox Kantianism, and I'll bring these more to experiential level in a couple of slides. He said that they were trying to bring it more in accord with modern science. And the psychologists may speak of sense impressions, but so far as logic is concerned, we can speak only of contents and content relations, which are defined in and through thinking. So the neo-Kantians were idealists. They thought of all knowledge as being involved in the circle of reason.
So hence the neo-Kantians appropriated Hegel's view of the absoluteness of reason and saw their task as correcting Kant and purifying scientific theory through epistemology. So they were studying the structure of knowledge. That's what Heidegger said. They're studying knowledge instead of that which knowledge is knowledge of. They're not studying beings, they're studying knowledge of beings, which he rejected. Okay, so although Heidegger was trained in the rival Southwest branch of neo-Kantianism under Windelbaum and Rickert, who focused on psychology, culture, and history, which Geiss's vision chopped him, rather than natural science and then Naturwissenschaften chopped him, he distanced himself from this rationalist epistemology far more radically than had Cassirer. Both Cassirer and Heidegger, however, had gone back themselves directly to Kant, and they understood him far better than the neo-Kantians had. And we must understand their differences at Davos by comparing their diverse interpretations of Kant, which have significant consequences. Okay, so it went from exchange, friendly exchange, to disputation. So this is the second round. Cassirer defended Cohen and his own commitment to mathematical natural science, and then he proceeded to attack positions that Heidegger presented in Being and Time. Cassirer denounced Heidegger's description of human finitude, arguing that symbolic imagination and Kant's categorical imperative both provide breakthroughs to the infinite, making possible freedom from the constrictions of concrete life. Heidegger, Cassirer asserts, must provide a similar breakthrough to the mundus intelligibilis, where appearances fall away and freedom reigns. How, Cassirer asks, can Heidegger's finite creature have absolute knowledge? Heidegger could not possibly mean to reject objectivity and the universality of truth by making truth dependent upon human Dasein, as he claims in Being and Time. So it would follow that a finite creature can possess no eternal truths, no necessity. Kant uses mathematics as an example that universal necessity exists. So Cassirer boldly suggests that if Heidegger would only pose these questions to himself, he would have to make different claims. The condescension here, based on Cassirer's complacent acceptance of age-old assumptions, releases Heidegger from his previous restraint. The balance of power in the debate begins to shift as Heidegger deftly deconstructs the unquestioned polarities of Cassirer's traditional mode of thought. So I want to pause for a minute and explain the word Dasein, because it's going to be, the word Da in German means both here and there, but we're going to stress the here. You know, if you say Da bin ich, we would translate that as here I am. You know, it also suggests time. So Da und dort, here and there, can also mean now and then. So Sein means being. So as a noun, Dasein is an everyday German word that means existence or life, like das Dasein erleichtern, meaning life, you know, making life easy for oneself. Since it's a verb, it means being here. Is Herr Olsen da? Ja, Herr ist schon da. So is Mr. Olsen here? Yes, he's already here. So the word da, we need to think, is usually translated as being there. We need to translate it as being here. So Heidegger gives Dasein a special meaning that relies on paying attention to its structure, i.e. da and sein. Dasein is the fundamental structure of human existence, our being, sein, our existing here in space and time, da. So for Heidegger, we're not encapsulated in a body, but we're outside of ourselves in the sight of our experience, and which is spatial and temporal. So by referring to human being as Dasein, as being in the world, Heidegger bypasses such preconceived concepts as subjectivity, self, ego, soul, spirit, consciousness, identity, etc., and makes possible a new relation to human wholeness. So Heidegger's counterattack. To Heidegger, Cassirer's notion of escape from finitude through symbolic reason was an inauthentic avoidance of mortality. As Skidelsky puts it, for Heidegger, true freedom is not freedom from Dasein, but rather becoming free for the finitude of Dasein. The task of philosophy is not to console man with thoughts of eternity, but to awaken him to his own nothingness. So Heidegger indicated that eternity is a false interpretation of the essence of time. Metaphysical claims about the ion depend on an inner transcendence within the essence of time that makes possible a horizon with respect to future, present, and past. Implied here is Heidegger's critique of the static quality of eternal being as posited by the Greeks, you know, with Aristotle's unmoved mover. So his overthrow of the fundamental assumption buttressing over two millennia of Western thought. If being itself is temporal, becoming disappears, and everything dependent on the vanished polarity must be rethought. This will require another beginning to master the first beginning of Western thought. So Heidegger concedes that being does have something infinite about it, but what about man himself, he asks? Is man infinite or finite? So as an infinite being, God does not need the categorical imperative. Its use confirms man's finitude. And truth, although nature does not depend on man, without Dasein or man, there would be no truth, ontologically speaking. So this does not mean that everyday ontic truths are subjective. It means without man, neither would truth exist. So Heidegger then asks Kassira, what is man's path to infinity? Is infinity a privative idea, a mere logical denial of finiteness, or is it a region? And what is philosophy's relation to anxiety? So my task tonight is not to give a blow-by-blow account of the dissertation as a whole, but to differentiate the standpoints of the disputants in order to show how these differences guide and derive from their interpretations of Kant and their understandings of human beings. Strangely blindsided by this question into his own assumption, Kassira responds that man reaches infinity through form. But something seems awry here in this answer because form would seem to be finite. And he then speaks of an imminent infinitude reached by going in all directions, referencing Goethe. This seems to border on incoherence. Leo Strauss, his grad student, reported that the learned professor and great man of culture suddenly seemed completely lost. Said another student of Kassira's, Heiner's pause, interrupted the event, stood up to defend Kassira, saying that the two men spoke a completely different language and that they needed a glossary. So Heidegger took over for the flux Kassira and gave a clear exposition in the main outline of Kassira's philosophy's symbolic forms, which Kassira was so flux he couldn't do. And then he pointed out the differences. Kassira, said Heidegger, sought to explain culture but without asking who or what man is. He said, my own thought, Heidegger speaking, his own thought, focused on who man is, but is certainly not yet in a position to found culture. So what basis, he asks, this is Heidegger, so what basis does Kassira have for beginning with logos, you know, consciousness, reason? He said, has he shown that that's a valid starting point? So Kassira assumes a certain shaping power, certain forms and structures without elucidating them. So Heidegger then launched into an eloquent depiction of his own thoughts on the Finnic life and the language of living experience and criticized Kassira's facile use of inherited concepts. So what does this mean to us? So I'd like to pull back from the fray and elucidate what I see as the most significant underlying issues that all the other treatments that I've seen in this debate overlook. So we have to go below the surface and compare the respective readings of Kant from Kassira's philosophy of symbolic forms and the early lectures of Heidegger that are now available. So Michael Friedman argues that Heidegger's fundamental ontology and his reopening of the question of being, his claim of human finitude, the revelatory power of death and nothingness, and his attempt to identify propositional truth as dependent upon prior levels of non-rational cognition would counter to the positivism of logical analysis and analytical philosophy. He therefore created a bifurcation of Western thought that was solidified by the separation of Europe by World War II, so that analytical thinking in England and America rejected European continental thinking led by Heidegger, and vice versa. Wittgenstein, members of the Vienna Circle, Kassira, and others fled west, while Heidegger joined the Nazis and remained and would heavily influence subsequent continental tradition, including existentialism, ethics, hermeneutics, theology, classics, literary theory, and psychoanalysis. So at stake in the disputation is nothing less than what constitutes human being. Is a human being a conscious animal or something deeper? Is consciousness foundational or founded? Is being static or temporal? Is truth timeless or historical? Is it enough to be rational, or should we also be authentically human? How should we live? So which is it fundamentally? At stake in our understanding of the issues in the disputation is nothing less than what constitutes human being, how we understand our relation to the world, and how we should register importance in our lives. The issues depend upon how we see these basic terms. are things as Kasir assumes, or as Heidegger claims? Is being eternal and unchanging, or, whoops, or is that, is being temporal and ethical? Is that helpful? Yeah, sorry.
Everybody I doctor.
Yeah. So, is truth objective and universal, or is truth perspectival, historical, and Dasein dependent? Is freedom transcendence from world, or is freedom authentically being in the world? Do we spontaneously create our worlds, or do we find ourselves already within existing worlds? Are we primarily thinking beings, or does care for our own being underlie all of our thinking disclosures? Do we find liberation through timeless symbol systems, or do we find liberation by anticipating our mortality? So must we take these differences simply as matters of opinion, or can we elucidate the meaning of these alternatives by considering the ways that Kasir and Heidegger interpret Kant? All right, so the different takes on the shared background. So Kant's resolution of a problem inherited from Descartes. So Descartes says, I can deny everything, even that I'm awake and not dreaming, even that I have a body, but I cannot deny that I'm thinking, cogito ergo sum. I'm a thinking substance and differ from the extended substances around me. How can I be sure that the things are as I see them? Maybe I have to believe that God doesn't deceive me. So Kasir created a disjunction between the thinking being and everything else around them. And so even today, analytical philosophers worry about what's the connection between body and mind? You know, and by extension, what's the connection between mind and the outside world? But that's weird. That's because they're Cartesians. Kant says it's a scandal of philosophy is a doubt about the external world. And in a letter to his friend Marcus Hertz, he said, he raised the question, what is the ground of the relationship between what is called in its representation and the object? So this is the central problem of the Critique of Pure Reason. Now this problem is not solved in the transcendental aesthetic, it's solved in the transcendental logic and the deduction of the pure concepts and the understanding, which is A84 to 1A130. So, and here we're talking about the a priori grounds of the possibility of experience. So Kant says we don't learn space and time empirically because we can't tell something happens after another one empirically because we already have to know time in order to know that. Same thing with positions in space. So space and time are intuitive structures of our being. And then what we see in this space and time, so if I look out here tonight, if I think about this later on, I'll remember that all this is a unity. So there's a synthesis of this first level of intuition, the manifold in space and time. And then imagination goes through the synthesis. This all happens spontaneously below the level of consciousness. These three steps have to occur before anything is given to our consciousness. So imagination goes through things and identifies it, and that's the way, if we see it for the second time, we know it's the same thing. Now, my father-in-law is 89, he got Alzheimer's, and he lost his ability to have the synthesis of the imagination. So I would walk in, and he'd say, well, do you know my daughter? You know, and maybe and then we'd talk, and he'd know who it was, but if I left the room and came back, he wouldn't know who it was anymore. So we have to look to the brilliance of Kant to realize that it's this synthesis of the imagination that makes possible the connection of our experiences to the next time we see them. Okay, so then the third level that happens is a spontaneous conceptualization. The idea of unity, possibility, and all these basic concepts are associated to something, and then something is given to us. So we have a concept. So like where the realist thinks, we look out and see the world, and then we analyze it for the first time, what Kant says is there's a process. Everything that we see in our experience has already gone through these three levels of synthesis in our brains below our level of consciousness before we are even aware of them. So, but Kant says that these processes can be both have an a priori and an a posteriori function. So in other words, on one level they happen spontaneously, so an object's given to us. But once an object is given to us, we can then carry out these processes consciously. So we can carry out the same synthesis and we can develop things from it. But there's this doubling of that happens. So Kant was immediately misunderstood. All right, if you have this connection, so I'm in the world and I have this intuitive connection of space and time, and then I synthesize it imaginatively, then I add concepts to it. I'm bonded to the world. Okay, but when people began trying to understand Kant, they went back to their original idealistic standpoint, and they lost this the achievement that Kant made.
So the misreading subjectivity is it read it back into the encapsulated Cartesianism, that the body, the mind is encapsulated in the body. And this, in consciousness, this began immediately with Reinhold, who was a friend of Kant. Kant was too old at the time. He felt it was more important to continue working than it was to correct this terrible misinterpretation. He said it would take 100 years before he was understood. He was way too optimistic. So he said, but this way of reading him as though he were encapsulated was accepted by Fichte and Hegel and the Neo-Kantians, and it became the traditional view. So even in the 20th century, V.S. Strawson, the famous Kantian, in London, says nothing is given us except perception. So Kant, if you synthesize the world to Strawson, that means that each person has its own private perception. So nothing's given to us but perceptions. Your perceptions are not given to me, nor mine to you. So Strawson declares that Kant is a transcendental solipsist. This is a complete misunderstanding of Kant. So everything depends on how we read Kant's statement. Space and time are within us. So to Kant, he says, when we experience the empirical world, it's within space and time, and space and time are within us. Okay, if you're a Cartesian and you think of things from a common sense perspective, that means that the world is inside the mind. And so everybody says that Kant is a veil here. And inside, we synthesize the world, and we have it inside us, and it's locked in there. You know, and that's why my perceptions are not your perceptions. But what if you read it in a more dramatic way? If space and time are within us, that's a redefinition of subjectivity, which means our subjectivity encompasses space and time. Everything that's within our field of experience is part of our subjectivity. We're the ones that's experiencing it. We're the ones synthesizing it. We're the ones applying color to it. We're the ones that are giving it meaning. We're the ones that put it in space and time. So our subjectivity is outside of us. Heidegger was one of the first to see that. So there's a partial agreement on externality. Now, in the philosophy of symbolic forms, Cassirer is one of the first people to realize that Kant was speaking of the externality. He said the meaning of subjectivity has undergone a corresponding transformation. I won't read the whole statement because it's a little bit dense, but basically he understands that subjectivity is a relation to the outside world, and that's our subjectivity. But the difference between Heidegger and Kant is that Cassirer read this subjectivity operably, which was in advance, but he read it as only a posteriori. So in other words, a ready-made subjectivity would then begin to look at the world through consciousness and would form it either religiously or scientifically or mythologically or artfully or poetically, whatever. But it's a conscious creation. And he was totally against any kind of thing below consciousness. All right, so Heidegger instead focuses on the deep structure of Kant's argument. The three stages of synthesis, intuition, imagination, and concept, are prior conditions of the possibility of consciousness is precognitive. The a priori within us of space and time means not only that subjectivity encompasses externality of empirical experience, but that the world is part of Dasein. So as I discover myself in the world, as soon as I become conscious of something, I'm already in the world, already bound to it, and it affects me as much as I expect it. So then my own understanding of myself is historical, because it's happening in a specific place of time and space. All right. So this means that as we become conscious of things, we find ourselves simultaneously in the world with them, a world already occupied by other beings. Therefore, we do not form the world of our choice spontaneously out of logos. We don't begin with consciousness or logos or concepts, as Cassirer thought. Is that this prior being in is the foundation of all possible propositions, live ontologically in relation to truth, and falsity prior to any object sense of truth. And every propositional truth is founded upon something on a deeper level. So if like a scientist, a physicist starts talking, a physicist sees objects and starts telling you about the objects. He's looking at them as Cassirer would externally. But Heidegger says, how is it that you have objects? But the table doesn't have objects. You know, the human being, for us to have objects, that means there's a prior set of processes that go on. And that's what he's reaching through his... And so then, if you take Jungian psychiatry, Jung Jung's understanding of the unconscious needs to be rethought into these terms. Because when Heidegger then speaks of Dasein as being in the sight of experience and in the world, then you have a fuller sense of humanity, which includes everything without defining it. It doesn't split. So it's not enough, like as Jung says, to speak of the unconscious. Because if you call it the unconscious, you're still making consciousness the main goal. You're really seeing things in opposition to it. So that's really a false way to start. So anyway, Heidegger is the... it gives us a better way of dealing with this, but all this, Heidegger's works are still being translated. There's about 80 volumes put out so far. It's scheduled to be 102. One of those may be an index, I'm not sure, but there, maybe that, with that many, there may be a couple indexes. Okay, so, what happened here? Okay, all right, so this is the next to the last slide here, so don't get frightened about, I set my time 45 minutes, but I forgot to push the start button. So I didn't know if I had time for this, so I made it pretty dense, but I wanted to say, if I can. So Cassirer's Cartesian, Hegelian, Neo-Kantian rationalism found its ultimate confirmation, Cassirer believed, in quantum theory. He argued this in his book, which I didn't mention before, Determinism and Indeterminism in Modern Physics in 1936, where the necessity of speaking of both particles and waves means that a single symbol system is not adequate to describe physical reality. So he has all these different philosophy of symbolic forms, multiple symbolic forms, and all of them are together are going to be required to describe reality. So Cassirer's dream, though, his scientific dream, is liberation of the human spirit from the primitive participation mystique to the total objectivity of the theory of everything. But this dream is an abstraction of consciousness. It's a view from nowhere by nobody, a divine snapshot from outside of existence. Yet this view is still implicitly dominant in the 21st century. So this is the historically evolved destiny of Aristotle's identification of human being with rationality attached to an animal, the zoon logikon. This is the totality of this total deracination of human consciousness produced through a collusion of post-Platonic philosophy, Christianity, modern technology is manifested as the Western form of nihilism already diagnosed by Nietzsche. But this emptying out of the human being and the meaning it has unlocked simultaneously a powerful increase in our control over the material environment. The paradox is that the very capabilities that have enabled this achievement are ultimately negated by the last step of objectivity, which means the destined erasure of all trace of the subject. So, arising out of the ashes of a destroyed Europe, taking Nietzsche's seriously and Kierkegaard and Bergson's diagnosis of the West's mistaken honoring of reason over life, but going further than Nietzsche's reversal of Platonism, which preserves the false polarities, Heidegger reopens the question of being, left unchallenged by Christianity, where Aristotle left it to be picked up again by Hegel. Being in time was the first step in a lifelong effort by Heidegger to initiate another beginning of Western thought, a beginning that would interweave itself with the greatness of the first beginning in order to master it properly for the first time without losing sight of the abyssal nature of being. So Davos fascinates because of its potentiality to split Western philosophical history into two movements. On a less grand scale, it marked the end of the dominance of neocontinentalism. The split between Anglo-American positivism and continental posthumanism, which Michael Friedman laid at Heidegger's door, is a small affair compared to the serious rethinking of the nature of being and truth that would integrate these opposites represented by Cassirer and Heidegger. So Cassirer's stance is that of a conscious envisioning, a kind of third-party scientific voyeurism in an all-seeing eye that cannot see itself. Heidegger, rejecting the identification of human being with pure consciousness, begins with a pre-conscious awareness of being and explores human being from within being itself as a temporality of existence. So, this is the last slide. By the fourth exchange, Cassirer had recovered. He lamented that, according to Heidegger, the bridges between them had been destroyed. He claimed that after Kant's so-called Copernican revolution, a unified sense of being was no longer possible, since each discipline was its own symbolic world. So you had art world, you had religious world, you had mythological world. Each one of those had its own concept of being. And its own notion, it took shape between subjectivity and its intended object. Heidegger countered the Dasein being here was prior to both subject and object. as well as all conscious disciplines, and that there was no counterpart to Kassir's work to describe the precognitive sphere of primordial experience. So Peter Gordon, in his 2013 book, Continental Divide, Heidegger, Kassir, and Davos, reported that the debate split along archetypal lines that could not be resolved. There may be a parallel here to Socrates exhorting the Athenians to care more for the health of the soul than for their wealth in the world around them. Heidegger's stress is recovering the proper relation to being to escape the nihilism of technology. Kassir focused not on the soul, but on the rational development of the disciplines. If we regard both modes of human exploration and development important, then there is much still to ponder in the implicit gulf between Kassir and Heidegger. Both of them might be somewhat still beyond us, but we'll have to stretch a bit before we can attempt a synthesis. So, that's it. How long did that take?
That was great. That opens us up now to a little bit of Q&A. I'm going to let you go first. John. Bob is director emeritus of the Dallas Foster Swarming. He founded it back, well, you were one of the founding members about 30 years ago.
No, I was in the second year.
Second year, okay. So you weren't here. There's no one here in the inaugural year of Dallas Foster Swarming. But anyway, please ask if you keep your comments relatively short and get to your question.
I find a lot of feelings from your talk because it reminded me, as a Jew, I hate the Nazi, but I have to agree with the Nazi in this case.
Yeah.
Heidegger is totally correct.
Yeah.
When I look back at Descartes, in his split of, you know, the human being, mm-hmm. I mean, that almost destroys philosophy until the existentialists like Heidegger come along and reunite the human into one.
Right.
But the irony is, without the split that Descartes makes, we wouldn't have modern science, because science was able to come out of it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of ambiguity to this.
Right.
So I've enjoyed your talk very much. It reminded me of all of this.
Well, thanks. You know, when Professor Osley said that Kassir was being judged to be the winner, and then I would say, well, no, I'm going to go back and defend Heidegger. But then as I got into it, I realized it's far more complicated, because we have the world of being that Heidegger talks about is extremely important, but at the same time, we're not going to give up our iPhones and our computers and all the things that technology does. So what we have to do is find a way of integrating those. And so this is an antinomy, a Kantian antinomy. And we have both of these, and then it's going to be very difficult for us to, you know, our future is going to be integrating these.
Good to hear, Dr. Brown. Question?
Yes. Likewise, I enjoyed your lecture very rapid. I picked up that you also appreciate Jungian psychology.
Yeah.
Now, Jung had the concept of the collective unconscious,
mm-hmm.
not just the individual.
Right.
How do you relate that we have access, or we are influenced by a collective unconsciousness?
Yeah, I think the only problem, I don't have a problem with what Jung is trying to express. Yeah. I just have a problem that calling it unconscious is still tying it to a kind of a Cartesian structure. And we have to find a way of expressing that with other words besides its consciousness. But the same, so that in Heidegger's sense of Dasein, and even in a lot of the things that Hegel describes, your objective spirit, there we approach something like what Jung means by collective unconscious. And I'm still working on how I want to actually say that. But so I like the idea, but...
Well, you know, he emphasizes intuition also.
Yeah, Jung.
And having been to the Jung Institute twice in Zurich, taught in Switzerland, it's really interesting how he integrates the different styles of thinking and intuition.
Yeah, he was very Kantian. He complained that I don't know how to turn that off here.
Turn this off.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He complained in medical school that he could only read Kant on Sundays. So he would, but he stopped at Kant. And that's one of the problems, because he read Kant as a neo-Kantian would read him. And so he read a Kant as somehow encapsulated, because he would speak about that we could never break out of the cycle. So that when he spoke of religion, for instance, he says, I'm not talking about God, actually, I'm talking about the archetype of God, which is in the psyche, and we can never go beyond that. And so Heidegger attacks that notion. And Jung, even though he was tremendously able to integrate a large number of things, he didn't like competition, you know. And you know, so if you read his seminars, sometimes the professor would stop by and ask a very good question, and you know, Jung would go off on him so badly he would never come back, you know. And he had outrageous things to say about both Hegel and Heidegger. But one thing, when I went to Zurich, I asked a lot of people. I said, Herr Heidegger came for 9 years every year to the Zolkan, you know, seminars, and he talked to the psychiatrist there. I said, was Jung at those meetings? And no one, I couldn't find anybody who even cared. And one time I was in a bookstore and opened up a book by, what's his name? It's a philosopher scientist from Berkeley. He just happened to open it up. He said he was at Zurich. And I thought, what's this? So I'm looking at it. He said he was at Jung's house, and Jung said, Heidegger's coming for lunch, which he often does. And he says, you're welcome to stay, but you have to drop your fire oven. You'll have to drop your sarcasm. And he said it wasn't worth it. So he left, you know. And so I thought, well, okay, I got confirmation that Jung and Heidegger were communicating. I mean, what to be a fly on the wall for those conversations would be, if you had someone like Eckermann, like Goethe had, you know, it would have been good. But they did talk, but Jung still said a lot of very hostile things to Heidegger. He was in a complex about Heidegger. Question here.
Okay, yeah. I think the end of your presentation begs a question. Okay. Is that integration possible? And I sense that you lean in that direction, but do you think an integration, synthesis is possible?
Well, if it's not possible, then it means that there's a split in the human being. The human being is a dualistic creature. So we have, I mean, like Plato keeps saying, I'm trying to teach people to pay more concern for their soul than for gaining wealth in the world. And once they reach wholeness, then they're much better able to function in the world. And so you reach wholeness first. Now, that may be the way he integrated, and maybe that's the way of doing it. Once you absorb, you know, the Heidegger's idea and you get the soul. I think that the one statement that was kind of dense that I read, but I wanted it in there, that if you speak of the ion, how does Heidegger, who speaks of temporality, and the fact that our universe now is not even eternal, you know, we have a big bang. I mean, this whole idea of the eternal idea of the Greeks really doesn't suit us. But so how do we speak of these truths that seem to be true across time? And so Heidegger speaks of this internal transcendence of time, so we can all look back and past and look ahead into the future. And in this line is a truth that we can all recognize. It's going to be true as long as we can. So, but it's still within our temporality, because none of us know for sure that something's eternal, because we can't wait around for it, you know. So that, but if we could understand it, you know, it's somehow inside this, maybe there is a way. So I don't know. I'm hoping there's a way, either that or the human being is hopelessly bifurcated.
Okay, who do you think had the strongest argument, and why?
Well, I think that Heidegger had the strongest argument. Just the fact that when Cassirer was so committed to these ideas of eternity and infinity, so forth, and then Heidegger says, "Okay, what's man's connection to these?" And suddenly it's like he never thought of that. You know, so he was using terminology that he just accepted. So he took what philosophy of history had given to him. And he even took this structure, the three-part structure of Kant, and then he applied it into each one of his volumes of Philosophy of Symbolic Forms, and he gave it different names. So Heidegger says that philosophy is not like a toolkit. You can't just take certain little construct out of one philosophical, like out of Hegel, and then come over here and put it over here and think it still works and still has its own integral meaning. He said once you do that, you have to rethink it completely. So Heidegger was way beyond Cassirer as a philosopher. Who was a better man? Cassirer, you know. But apparently, we don't know what it is yet, but I know Charles Bombach, who's a specialist in Heidegger, says that this summer there's going to be something published in Heidegger that's going to be his worst collusion to Nazism that we know and we've heard about yet. So we don't know fully the depth of it. I mean, you know, that was a certain period of his life, and his books are on, I mean, when you read what Heidegger says about Plato, there's nothing about Nazis or anything connected to it in there. So you can read Heidegger, you know, for years and never stumble on anything that's related to Nazis. But the fact he did, he was, you know, he had this anti-Semitic impulse, and he made anti-Semitic comments to his, you know, to his wife, sharing them with his wife in his letters. And, you know, it's the same time as he had an affair with Hannah Arendt. He was, he had, you know, carried on a relationship, I mean, a correspondence with Paul Celan, the Jewish, you know, poet who had been in the concentration camp. And so it's a complicated situation.
He changed a lot of his ideas in the Brown Book and the Blue Book, you know, from being in college. He was always...
Oh, yeah, changing. He changed, yeah. In the Beitrage, the contribution to philosophy, he's gone. There's actually a lot of criticisms of the Nazi, of the historical movement and the mass movement, and he just never made these public. In fact, he asked for this not to be published during his lifetime. So it's hard to pin down what was actually going on. It's, sometimes I think of it as like, if you see a tenor who's got this fantastic operatic voice, he turns out in real life to be a jerk. You know, does that affect his singing? I mean, you could still enjoy, you know, what he sings. You know, I don't know.
Or a brilliant surgeon that has a poor bedside manner.
Yeah, I mean, we would like to think that to study philosophy makes you a wonderful human being. You know, but maybe it doesn't.
Okay, let's give a round of applause again to Dr. Brown. And we have a certificate of appreciation that we want to thank him for his time.
Oh, well,
time to Dr. Brown. And we invite you back again. And in 2 weeks, who do we have in 2 weeks, David? Who do we have speaking in 2 weeks? Who do we have?
At the Crossroads of Freedom and
Faculty. At the Crossroads of Freedom on signing to vote for Bourdieu?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So in 2 weeks, we'll have that presentation. Thanks again for coming. And feel free to stick around for the next few minutes. And we appreciate your attendance and see you in 2 weeks.